Well, you can all imagine my delight when I discovered that I could draw on some work by my former local member, Andrew Lee, also up until recently the shadow assistant treasurer, and a former professor of bourgeois economics at the Australian National University. To have such a prop in understanding the nature and characteristics of alienation was a real thrill. Lee, following the work of the US political scientist Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone, quite a famous study of the way in which people have been isolated and become more isolated, using the concept, a dubious concept called social capital, which basically means connectedness and trust, Lee published a book in 2011 which documented in actually genuinely quite useful ways some features of alienation under capitalism, and particularly in Australia. So he looked at the decline in community organisations and volunteering. Active members of organisations dropped from 14% to 4% of the population between 1967 and 2004. You know that organised religion is in decline in Australia. He talked about the decline in party membership, and I've updated his figures to some extent here. For the ALP, which had 75,000 members in 1953, there were only about 40,000 members in 2010, and they're still claiming that, in a population that's twice as large as in 1953. Union density has fallen from a peak of 51% in 1976 to only 14% in 2016, a fall in absolute terms from 2.5 to 1.5 million members. The numbers involved in playing organised sports and even the proportion of people attending sporting and other entertainment events apart from cinema has also declined. People report that they have fewer friendships and they have fewer interactions with their neighbours. There is a rising proportion of people who live by themselves. And to these features of alienation, our separation from our fellow human beings, we can add some other ones. In 2007, 45% of Australians experienced a mental disorder at some time during their lifetime, and 20% were experiencing a mental disorder in the previous year. I read a report that somebody pointed out to me on Facebook that 22% of millennials in the USA have no friends. How do we explain this? How do we explain these features of alienation? Well, Andrew Lee, who as a bourgeois economist says that markets and neoliberalism are not to blame, and he explains that because you can have really good relations with people at your local shops as you're engaging in your commercial market-based transactions. And what's more, he sees no connection between the market and, more accurately, actually capitalism, and the following causes that he does identify. These include longer working hours, nothing to do with capitalism, commuting by car, that is the dispersal of the population over wider areas, yeah, further and further away from work, anti-union legislation, capitalist class isn't interested in that, TV, and there he means really home entertainment, and, well, that doesn't have anything to do with capitalism either, does it? I mean, if you're overworked, clearly that won't affect your inclination to go out for entertainment, will it? Women joining the workforce, Andrew seems to think that domestic labour somehow allowed women to be more connected with other people. Impersonal technologies like auto tellers and online shopping, because you know there's scope for interacting with the other person you're handing the money over to, when actually these free up time for meaningful interaction as opposed to the meaningless interactions of the market. And ethnic diversity. Now, Andrew says that he likes living in an ethnically diverse sort of a neighbourhood, not that that's all that common in Canberra. And he's not clearly a racist, but numbers. You know, statistical surveys indicate that ethnic diversity in a suburb and lower levels of trust, lower levels of social capital go together. I think we may be able to go beyond Andrew's explanations of these features of alienation and look at deeper causes of atomisation. In pre-capitalist societies, most people, even those who weren't part of ruling classes, were more connected with others and less alienated in that sense, even if they were exploited and oppressed. Life in general and production in particular were organised in relatively small communities in which people knew each other on a personal level. Except for slaves, those who produced wealth had greater control over the processes of production than is the case today, the process of production, the way they organised their immediate work process. It is true that levels of productivity were much lower and that most of the population, even those who weren't slaves, were not free to enjoy life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness, as the US Declaration of Independence have it, or for that matter, liberté, égalité, fraternité, the great slogan of the great French Revolution 13 years after US independence. The triumph of capitalism changed life for ordinary people in terms of exploitation, oppression and alienation in very fundamental ways. It brought about a double freedom that included equality before the law, a degree of individual autonomy and a sense of being brothers and sisters in the family of the nation. Capitalist freedom was freedom from extra economic constraint, but also freedom from ownership of productive resources. And now Nat has indicated to me that we can hear from that famous Marxist Janis Joplin. Let's do that again. Well, you can hum me and Bobby McGee to yourselves.
Click on the...
Oh, click... Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's this... Moment. Where's the volume? No, you're going to have to hum it to yourselves. I'll just click it again so that... Janice doesn't interrupt me later on. Because the chorus, of course, is freedom's just another word for nothing left to use, in rather more tuneful tones than I have just expressed it. As the Communist Manifesto put it in terms of the transition from feudalism to capitalism, in, I think, lyrical terms, that the Communist Manifesto is a fantastic piece of lyrical prose. The bourgeoisie, wherever it has got the upper hand, has put an end to all feudal, patriarchal, idyllic relations. It has piteously torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound people to their natural superiors, and has left no other nexus between people than naked self-interest, than callous cash payment. It has drowned out the most heavenly ecstasies of religious fervour, of chivalrous enthusiasm, of Philistine sentimentalism, in the icy water of egotistical calculation. It has resolved personal worth into exchange value, and in the place of the numberless, indefeasible chartered freedoms has set up that one unconscionable freedom, free trade. Capitalism created a new kind of individual defined by personal characteristics rather than inherited status. Capitalism's generalised commodity production opened up choices for individuals, choices on commodity markets and choices on the market for the most important commodity, that is labour power, our ability to work. But that freedom was also accompanied by coercion and ideological measures by bosses and states to discipline workers into being the right kind of free individual. That is, punctual and obedient at work, temperate in the consumption of alcohol and other pleasurable drugs, dutiful in relation to family, and appreciative of ruling class cultural pursuits. Earlier than the Communist Manifesto, about 4 years before, in his economic manuscripts of 1844, but also this is continued in Capital in important ways and other later works, Marx identified the way in which capitalist relations of production entail four forms of alienation. The most obvious of these is alienation from product. We do the work, we make the thing that the boss sells. The boss gets to own the product of our labour. Very straightforward. We're also alienated from our fellow workers. We're in competition with other workers for jobs in the first place, then for promotion, for avoiding the sack, and this drives us towards individualism and scepticism about other human beings. Bosses in the state also reinforce workers' alienation from each other when they propagate and sustain racist and sexist ideas and practices, whether directly in the workplace or through the mass media or through government policy. Our experience of markets and money encourage us to regard other people outside the workplace as commodities, not only in the obvious case of prostitution, which of course predated capitalism, but also in terms of our material calculations about advantages in our relationships with others. More generally, under capitalism, the wage-labour-capital relationship means that for workers, the means of consumption are only accessible through employment and the individual relationship between employer and employee. In other words, we have to go to work to get money to buy things. And pay is individualised, and the consumption of what that pay will buy is mainly individual or through the family. The third form of alienation is alienation from control over work. There is a contested frontier, as I think it was Goodrich wrote about 1922, between the control that bosses exercise over the way we organise work, what we do at work, and workers' efforts to exercise that kind of control. A process of de-skilling has gone on under capitalism so that employers can more easily substitute one worker for another worker. Automation is another way in which control over what goes on at work is put into the hands of employers but through the medium of controlling the pace of machines and, more recently, computer technology that can detect how many keystrokes you do or how many calls you take in the call centre and how long you spend on them. Harry Braverman wrote a fantastic book in the early 1970s called Labour and Monopoly Capital that was precisely about our ongoing loss of control over work. Finally, Marx talked about our alienation from our species being, which really means from our nature as human beings, including our physical, our intellectual, and our emotional need. Work activities are, to a very significant extent, bad for us in direct and immediate ways, including, but not exclusively, repetition industry, injuries from doing the same kinds of motion, physical motion, over and over again, whether it's using a jackhammer on road construction or using a keyboard in a clerical job. Back problems for both manual and clerical workers, for bus drivers and for academics and all sorts of other clerical workers are very, very widespread, as I would guess some of the other older comrades in the room can attest. Then there's outright poisoning and other occupational health and safety dangers that occur in workplaces. And there's stress, which can take so many different forms. Stress over job security, stress over quotas and quality of work standards employed by bosses, stress because of long hours of work, stress over inadequate resources in order to do a job properly, if you have pride in your work, particularly if you're working in some sort of a caring industry. If you're a nurse and there aren't enough resources, and particularly if there aren't enough nurses and doctors, that is a stressor because you care about your patients. And there's the stress of fake emotions. Having to smile and be polite to fuckwit customers who you are serving in the hospitality industry or in retail. A US study found, this is a huge surprise, that faking and suppressing emotions with customers was related to drinking beyond the stress of the job or feeling negatively. And there's another stressor that I think is very characteristic of many jobs under capitalism, and that's boredom. That, you know, boredom is bad for you physiologically, and many jobs involve a lot of it. And there is, related to the previous form of alienation, lack of control over work, there is a lack of creative activity and work. The fact that it's somebody else who's telling us what to do and how to do the job rather than us having effective creative control over what's going on. And there's also alienation from our most intimate feelings and relationships and sensations. And I quote here from another Marxist whose status as an analyst of capitalism almost matches that of Janis Joplin. How often have you been too busy or too tired for love? And then when you found some time, it was the last thing at night, a quick 15 or 20 minutes before you went to sleep. Or it was a quickie first thing in the morning before work. In this kind of sex, time has entered into our lovemaking and brought with it the pressure that something has to happen and fast. So in our desire to create pleasure quickly, we move immediately towards orgasm because it feels good. And the Marxist tome I'm quoting from here is Diana Richardson's Tantric Sex. More broadly, we are alienated from the natural world of which we are a part. There was a talk earlier on in the conference about the metabolic rift that Marx mentions in Capital and deals with in a number of his notebooks. That is an alienation from the physical requirements that we have of the natural world and what capitalism actually does to the natural world of which we are a part, being biological creatures, and on which we depend. Marx, in particular, drew on the work of a pioneering German organic chemist called Liebig, talking about the impoverishment of the soil, the way in which the richness of the soil, its nutritive capacities, were translated into food in the cities, which was consumed in the cities, and then instead of it being recycled back to the soil in the countryside, it was flushed into rivers and out to sea. But we can also see a metabolic rift in other aspects of capitalism's treatment of the natural environment. We can look at it in terms of pollution. We can look at it in terms of the big issue at the moment, which is climate change, and we can see it in the destruction of complex ecologies and the spaces that we have for experiencing these complex ecologies as extinction spreads across the planet, blotting out unique natural environments and species. These forms of alienation have intensified in the course of capitalism's history. The Communist Manifesto also identified the way in which capitalism has a need to expand, not only geographically, which was what Marx focused on, but also into more and more aspects of life as they become commodities produced for profit. And this expansion has extended and deepened alienation. In the manifesto, Marx and Engels wrote, "The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere." And that's not just across the entire globe, it's across the entire experience of our daily lives. So, for example, the commodification of bodies beyond the form of wage labour itself, because we're effectively selling our bodies for a period of time, and beyond prostitution, which preceded capitalism and was associated with the emergence of money and the oppression of women, to commercial surrogacy and the porn industry. The commercialisation of entertainment, the turning of more and more aspects of entertainment into commodities, music, TV, movies, sports, social media, these are associated with atomisation and declines in do-it-yourself collective forms of entertainment and leisure. There is a very strong connection between Marx's discussion of alienation, which goes back a very long way, to before, in a real sense, he was a Marxist, the 1844 manuscripts, to Marx's very mature conception of how capitalism operated. Marx's theory of alienation, which still pervades his later work, developed into his theory of exploitation and his theory of the fetishism of the commodity, which is talked about in section 4 of chapter 1 of volume 1 of Capital. The fetishism of the commodity is really simply explained as the way in which capitalism camouflages itself and seems to be about the relations between things, commodities, rather than between human beings. Capitalism seems to be about markets rather than the relationships between human beings. But actually, commodities mediate the relationships between human beings. When I buy something at Woolies or Coles, I'm entering into a commodity-mediated relationship with the people who produced those things, although that is occluded, that is disguised from us by, well, the glamorous packaging and the delightful experience of Muzak in Coles and Woolies. Nevertheless, Despite and because of alienation and exploitation, we are still bound together. Human needs for physical and emotional sustenance and creative autonomy, these things give rise in the exploited and oppressed to resistance and struggle. As human beings, we need this physical and emotional sustenance, which includes a need to engage in creative work. And because we are deprived of these things, we push back, because capital, bosses, supervisors attempt to deprive us more and more of these things we need in order to survive, to push back. The capitalist project of reducing all our relationships to the callous cash payment is incomplete and cannot be completed while we remain biological, recognisable human organisms. Most importantly, the working class has a common interest, is compelled to fight for the fulfilment of its own needs, and in order to do so successfully, has to overcome divisions created by oppression. And capitalism bestows on the working class tremendous potential power, because it is our class that makes the world go round. It's our class that creates just about everything that we need, and certainly the things that we need that take the form of commodities. Furthermore, it's fundamental to Marx's insights that people's consciousness of who they are and their relationships with others changes through struggle. In periods of low levels of struggle, our sense of solidarity can decline, and as a consequence, our sense of alienation is likely to increase. But the experience of struggle, which is imposed on us if we are going to survive, sometimes it takes a very modest form. Doing that behind the boss's back, that's a pretty low level of struggle, but it's an indicator compared with mass strikes or the kinds of protests that we've seen in Hong Kong. These things will crop up again, will flare up again, as will revolutions. And in those periods of struggle, there is a potential for people to rethink what kind of individuals they are, what kind of individuals we are, to think of ourselves not as billiard balls who bounce off each other, which is the theory of that Andrew Lee subscribes to in the form of mainstream economics, but rather to think of ourselves as being part of a collectivity where our interests are not simply counterposed to those of other people, but where our interests are combined and are collective. So, what are we to do about things? Well, obviously the first place to look is in Andrew Lee's book. Okay. First thing he says, it's a really good idea to live in Canberra because the levels of social capital in Canberra are much higher than, marginally higher than they are in other parts of Australia. Now, I'm lucky, I live in Canberra, but suppose it's not an option for most of you. It's also the case, I'd point out, that Canberra has the highest average level of income in the country. The very wealthiest don't live in Canberra, but the average level of income is higher in Canberra than any other Australian city, and it has a pretty good urban design. It also is less ethnically diverse, the connection between ethnic diversity and social capital is highly dubious. We can also reward people for volunteering, like giving them a HEX discount. Sounds good, doesn't it, students? We can also make a difference by holding street parties, not parking across footpaths. Using the local shops rather than going into the bigger shopping centres. We can donate to good causes. We can use social media to build face-to-face connections. And we can revive our community organisations. We can volunteer for good causes. We can contact two politicians to criticise one and praise the other. I wonder why that came into Andrew's mind. We can have organise good social work lunches on the model of the Research Department of Economics at the ANU. And we can try out new activities. Well, some of these things might be nice to do, particularly if you want to get elected into Parliament. Happily, the list doesn't include ethnic cleansing, which is a corollary of Lee's own racist interpretation of his statistics. But they hardly address the underlying problem. There are other suggestions. Ideas about co-determination at work, which Bernie Sanders is very keen on, and there are models for this in the totally unalienated society of Germany, where co-determination has existed, well, not only throughout the post-war period, but also during the Weimar Republic, which gives a token right to be consulted to representatives of workers. Not sure about that. There are individual solutions. Mindfulness. If we're mindful and just concentrate on the issue at hand, being in the present, we can deal with our stress. And blame ourselves when the stress reasserts itself. I have two very straightforward alternatives. The first is a biggie, smash capitalism. The second one, if you can't achieve the first one immediately, is to join the struggle to smash capitalism so that it happens sooner. On the question of disagreeable kinds of work, well, the utopian socialist Charles Fourier had an answer to this. Children like dirt. We'll give them the dirty jobs. I'm not sure that that's really the best way of solving it. I think there's a different kind of a take on it, and that is the amount of time that humanity will need to expend on labour that is necessary for our physical survival can be, or is vastly less than the amount of time we actually spend working. There are huge areas of labour that can be just eliminated in a more rational society that is designed around human need. The financial sector, armaments industries, and so on. These can be eliminated. The amount of time that we will be compelled as a collectivity to engage in labour in order to make food, shelter, and so on will be diminished. So maybe there are jobs that nobody will really want to do, but the amount of time that will be necessary to spend on them will be dramatically less, and it will not be necessary for the same person to do that job all the time as their only kind of labour. So there can be some sort of rationing going on for that kind of labour. And what's more, our conception of why we labour, why we might do disagreeable work, I think will be very different, because our conception of what we are as individuals will be different. So we are prepared, even here and now under capitalism, well, most of us who aren't psychopaths, which I take it as most of us here, are prepared to do things that are disagreeable for our family, for our loved ones, and so on. I think the conception of connectedness with other people will mean a preparedness to do, for a limited amount of time, do jobs that are not very agreeable. So I think that's one response. On the question of well-being, budgets and other like bullshit. All sorts of politicians, not just Labor politicians, Conservative politicians as well, talk about the importance of mental health, the importance of looking after people. And the Labor Party is very proud of the NDIS, and so, for that matter, are the Tories in Australia. Now, I'd forgotten what NDIS stands for, National Disability Insurance. So I had to look it up. And what Google told me was something very important about the NDIS. There were four ads before we got to something substantive. In other words, the NDIS is really big business, as well as being shit for the people who are caught up in it, if you know anybody who has been caught up in this appalling market-based system. That is the kind of care that mainstream politicians want for us. Now, of course, it's important that we fight for changes within the framework of capitalism that can make life better for us. And as revolutionary socialists, we are engaged in those kinds of struggles within the framework of capitalism. But those struggles are struggles. They are opportunities to make arguments about solidarity. They are opportunities for people to experience a solidarity that the alienation of capitalism attempts to suppress. Those struggles are a stepping stone towards revolutionary politics. So I think that the basic takeaway message from this session, and the really valuable contributions that lots of people have made to it, should be that class struggle is not only good for bringing about revolution, for bringing about change, it's good for us as individuals in the here and now.